Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray, sponsored by Cybertrust.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of Risky Business, coming to you from the annual OSCERT Computer Security Conference on the Gold Coast. The conference is off to a cracking start. Yesterday's keynote by Ivan Kristic was a highlight. He got stuck right into software vendors over what he describes as miserably failing desktop security. More on that later. ZDNet Australia's Munir Katadia joins us in the flesh to chat about day one at the conference, and we'll be speaking to George Stafakopoulos, Microsoft's Head of Product Security, about mobile, Vista and Office security. We'll also check in with our sponsor, Cybertrust, to talk about their big news. They've been bought by Verizon Business. We'll find out what that means to the company's 180 Australian employees. But first, it's time to check in with Munir. Now, for once, we actually have the pleasure of joining Munir Katadia in the flesh for this week's news summary. Munir, how's it going?
Hey, how you doing there, Patrick?
Good, good. Now, this OSCERT just seems bigger and more insane than the last four.
It's so much fun. We got here on Sunday evening, walked in, were handed over a little beer, and before I knew it, we had interviews with some extremely important security people. I don't think there's any conference you can go to in the world where you can just walk in like that. It's such a small environment, and it's just packed to the brim with quality people.
Yeah, it almost feels like it's outgrown the venue a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, they apparently closed registrations a week before. When I spoke to them for a story I was doing the week before, they actually mentioned that that was a possibility. But yeah, so they were packed out. They were talking about 1,200 or so delegates.
Now, of course, we are recording this on the first day of the conference, which is the Monday, which I guess the time now is about 3:30 p.m. So we haven't really seen that much. But we did have an interesting keynote this morning from Ivan Kristic, or he's got something. Yes, he's got one of those impossible names from the Balkans. And he gave a very interesting presentation on desktop security, didn't he?
He was fantastic. He just basically blew desktop security out of the waters. He said it doesn't matter whether you're Windows or Linux or Mac.
I think you said it. You nearly said it blew a desktop security out the windows, which I wasn't going to
tell you. That would have been good. He was basically saying that desktop security is pathetic and it's annoying and it doesn't work and it's rubbish. And he went through this whole speech and he actually had a really good argument there, don't you think?
Yeah, no, it was quite amazing. We've got him coming up a little bit later in the show. And I mean, one thing that is noteworthy about Ivan is that he's only 21 years old, which is perhaps why he's got such fresh perspectives.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't think that at all. I mean, you know, the way he speaks up there, he's so confident. He's got such incredible ideas. I think he's definitely one to watch for the future. He's going to be a big, big name.
Now, while I was in the media centre slaving away over a piece for tomorrow's Sydney Morning Herald and Age newspapers, you caught the Microsoft Security Q&A. And I'm kind of sorry I've missed it from what you've said.
Oh, it was very, very funny indeed. We went in there. Now, last year, the room was totally packed. And apparently, there was a whole load of people after the Q&A session. You know, we didn't get to ask our question. And it was a real pain. And so they thought this year, they'll try and make it more fair. So as you walked in, everyone was given a little number. And they were told, you know, we'll pick out a number from the hat. And if your number gets called, then you get to ask a question. And it was kind of like a bingo type of thing. Doomed from the start, basically. Okay, the first guy... it was all right. It worked. From there on was the next 10 numbers they pulled out of the hat. Nobody was there. After 10 or so, everyone was looking very, very embarrassed. And, you know, there's Peter Watson. They're going, oh, no, what are we going to do? And they finally pick one out. And some guy goes, yes, I've got the number. And he thought he'd won something.
He thought he'd won an iPod or something.
They went up to him. And he goes, oh, I didn't know I had to ask a question. And the whole room erupted in laughter. It was so funny.
Oh, you got to... I guess it's kind of reassuring because, I mean, back in the day, any time that the public, especially at a security conference, got a chance to take a free poke at Microsoft, you'd have a line of about 50 guys there with some very pointed questions about their poor performance. But it seems this year people are kind of given up on hassling them.
Well, there were a couple that, you know, eventually they gave up with the whole bingo system and then they started probably saying, you know, if you've got a question, put your hand up. And that worked this time. And so, yeah, there was a guy there who was asking about NT4, you know, and he's saying, we still run NT4, we're at some government organisation.
Sounds very sensible.
And, and George's answer was upgrade. Yeah, you know, and there were some very short, sharp answers like that. But it was an interesting session, really.
Okay, quite candid. What are some of the other highlights you'll be watching for over the next few days?
Marianne Davidson, Oracle's chief security person. She's going to be around tomorrow, so be interesting to hear what she says and see if their unbreakable campaign is going to continue.
Yeah, well, we've got also David Litchfield, who's the continuous thorn in their paw. He's also at this conference. And it'll be interesting to see if we could perhaps get them in the room together.
Oh, can you imagine? That would be great. We'll have the video cameras out for that.
In fact, I believe you were with us last night at the bar while we had a bit of a chat to David, and he mentioned that he'd had dinner with Marianne Davidson recently, and I had to ask him if they used had to use plastic cutlery.
I like that.
Or just spoons, you know, because those two have been at each other's throats in the press for a number of years now. Well, look, Manir, we won't hold you up any longer. We're all very busy here, but thank you very much for your time this week again, as always.
It's been a pleasure. It's been great being here in the flesh.
Yesterday morning's opening keynote was brutal. Well, it was if you're an operating system vendor anyway. Ivan Krstic, the one laptop per child security architect, had some pretty damning things to say about product security. The One Laptop Per Child project aims to deliver a US$100 laptop to children in developing countries, and as Krstic points out, it would be a tragedy if the project failed due to some sort of computer worm or other vulnerability. But he dedicated most of his speech to trashing OS vendors. Here's a few minutes of his keynote speech from yesterday morning.
This industry has massively failed when it comes to desktop security in today's day and age. Desktop security right now is completely broken. It doesn't work. Let me rephrase this. People are not understanding that desktop security is about the user and not about phrases and protocols and abbreviations and algorithms that make sense to these people and very few other people that are not in the room with us.
That was an excerpt from Ivan Krstic's keynote speech at the OSCERT conference yesterday. I caught up with Ivan after his keynote for this interview. You just spent the better part of your presentation, your keynote here at OSCERT, savaging operating system security, particularly on the desktop. Can you sort of summarise what your theories are on desktop security as it exists now?
So much of desktop security as it exists focuses on the idea that responsibility for making security decisions and understanding of the security situation should be basically offloaded to the user. And that as long as the user is presented with the ability to allow things or deny things and make certain decisions of this kind, that that's essentially all that the that the industry should be providing. But you know, people that need to be protected, people that we want to be protecting as computer users, are people who don't have computer security degrees or computer science degrees, and so it's sort of a bad position to be in.
Now, you're involved with a number of Linux projects, is that right?
That's correct.
Ubuntu, in particular. What's your involvement with that project?
I'm one of the authors of the official Ubuntu book, and I was one of the administrators for the Ubuntu server team.
Now, I guess the One Laptop Per Child project has given you an opportunity to rethink desktop security to an extent, and you've decided that going with virtual machines is the way forward. How much of a rethink is that?
Historically, not very much. People have been trying to push. I mean, first of all, virtualization as a general concept has been around since the 60s. What's being done for One Laptop is we're trying to take a bunch of technologies that we've known about that have existed and try to combine them in a sort of a meaningful way that provides a lot of the kind of security guarantees that we're after. So it hasn't been about trying to invent brand screaming new things nearly as much as it's been trying to look at the past and pick out some of the good solutions that have been out there but not used and put them together in the right way.
So do you hope many of the operating system vendors will learn from the work that you're putting into the One Laptop Per Child project?
I think it'd be a bit condescending to say that I'm trying to teach anyone anything really about this, but I am certainly hopeful that the vendors will be interested in talking about the ideas that we're bringing up, because they are very different than how people are used to dealing with desktop security now.
So you're running basically every application as its own virtual machine, aren't you?
Essentially, yes.
Okay. Now, why is security particularly important to the One Laptop Per Child project?
There's any number of reasons. Certainly, you know, as an educational organization that's trying to focus on an educational mission, it would be absolutely tragic if the project failed because all the machines, you know, locked up or stopped working because the security was compromised. That's probably, you know, the number one nightmare scenario that I can come up with. But in addition to that, you know, there are all sorts of other concerns. I mean, sheerly by scale, by how many laptops we want to put out there, you know, we are definitely setting up a large monoculture. And monocultures are always scary from a security point of view. You know, you don't want to see the 10 million node botnet attacking people, for one.
So that's how many laptops you anticipate will be out there after a number of years for, as part of this project?
I'm actually anticipating there'll be many more.
So I guess, yeah, you don't want you know, your philanthropic efforts being turned into spam relays, do you?
Correct.
What are your top five criticisms of operating system security generally now?
I think the technical ones are, I mean, I think it can be boiled down to a single criticism, which is that there's this pervasive premise that a program that's running on a machine should execute with all of the permissions of the user that's executing it. And as long as that one premise is in place, I don't think that we'll see any significant leaps in system security on the desktop.
I mean, how much of that work that you're doing for one laptop per child will actually find its way into things like Ubuntu distributions?
There's a difficulty here. The reason that we are able to build Bitfrost, which is our security platform, and try and provide much stronger security is because, for a number of reasons, one of which is security, we decided to break backwards compatibility with normal applications. As you may imagine, normal vendors are not particularly eager to break backwards compatibility. And I think as long as they remain unwilling to do it, they're not going to be able to reap many of the benefits.
So this is almost an opportunity to just really start again from scratch, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. What would be the measure of success for you? What would need to happen over the next few years to have you say, I've done my job, we've really succeeded here? What needs to happen?
We'll have some pretty good indicators from the get-go of how successful the system is. We certainly will be able to look at, you know, intrusion attempts versus any successful intrusions. We'll be able to look at what kind of viruses, malware, and spyware people are trying to write for this platform and whether any of them are successful and actually being deployed in the wild. So I think there's a number of measures that we'll be able to use as metrics on whether we have succeeded or not. But it's also not at all a binary question. It's really not a, yes, we have succeeded, or no, we haven't succeeded at all, right? It's going to be, what I'm aiming for is we've succeeded in many more cases than normal desktop security does.
Ivan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was the One Laptop Per Child's project, Ivan Krstic. We'll be right back after this.
Checkpoint is the worldwide leader in securing the internet. Our focus is purely on IT security. Pure Security ensures customers' protection through unified, reliable, and extensible solutions. Learn more about the technology that secures 128 of Australia's top 200 companies at checkpoint.com.
You're listening to itradio.com.au's weekly security podcast, Risky Business, which is sponsored by Cybertrust. I'm Patrick Gray. There are some seriously impressive security types floating about here at the AusCert conference. Perhaps one of the most influential is George Stathakopoulos. He's the head of product security for Microsoft, and I chatted to him yesterday. So, George, obviously working on Vista was taking up most of your time, and that's sort of done now. So what are you focusing your efforts on now?
So Vista is not exactly done yet. We still have to see how it's going to fare over the next few months and learn some new lessons and figure out, like, you know, what has changed in the security environment. The things that we're working right now is seeing how the new generations of our products are going to fare. So we've been spending a lot of time with the design teams for Office, with Windows, with Exchange, with the mobile team, and to see what they're planning to do.
Yeah, now Office 2007, a lot of bug hunters these days are saying that that's really where the next tilling ground is going to be in the search for vulnerabilities because, you know, it's getting a lot harder to exploit operating systems. So are you guys really redoubling efforts in that area? Is that the main focus at the moment?
Yeah. So what happened is with the previous generation of Office, we did see an increase on security vulnerabilities. As the OS became more hardened and as it became stronger, right, we started seeing exploitation and security bugs coming in against the Office components, Word, Excel, and so on. Mm. So we learned quite a lot, especially for binary formats, which was a target for a lot of the hacker community during the last year or so. So we actually spent a lot of time hardening them in 2007. So in Office 2007, there is no more binary formats. We're using XML-based formats. Mm. So we expect the attacks will become significantly less. I mean, the things that are encouraging right now is that as bugs come in for Office, the previous generations of Offices, like 2003 and so on, 2007 seems to be okay.
Now, you mentioned mobile earlier. Yeah. What's the activity there? Because people have been tipping this as a big area for a number of years, and it hasn't quite happened. Do you think we're reaching the cusp where mobile vulnerabilities are actually going to become an issue? Because at the moment, they're just not.
I think it's like, you know, like Internet Explorer back in 1997, a lot of things were about theory and then they became reality, right? So in the mobile space, you know, especially as more people are using mobile devices, they have their emails, they have their documents, they have the staff there, you'd see like, you know, attention and focus from the security community. You'll see first exploitation of the stacks like Bluetooth and, you know, and then you're going to start seeing people trying to exploit, like, you know, the operating system itself. So the more we think about it, the more we take all the lessons we learned from, you know, our previous endeavors and we put them in there, I think things will be better.
Now, you got a lot of flack over UAC in Universal Access Control in Vista. I mean, how do you respond to that? Because it must be tough, because I know you put a lot of your time and a lot of energy into working on Vista and really trying to make it more secure. In retrospect, would you have done anything differently with UAC?
UAC is a pretty wonderful feature in a couple of ways. It's not necessarily a security mechanism per se, a first level of defense, but it's a great secondary level of defense, right? And what it does, I think it's a step towards a journey to actually tighten the system and don't have everybody running on as an admin, right? There is some things that we need to work on. We need to work in better UI. We need to make it more. More clear, you know, what is happening.
Will you be doing that in Vista as some sort of service pack, or is that on the cards?
I don't know if it's in the service pack, but I think it's something that we definitely continue investing, right? Because it is the right approach. There's no question about it. You don't want everybody to running as an admin. But getting there, you have to persuade, the ISVs to write applications that they actually, you know, support this. And it's just not really easy to go from 0 to 100 in 2 seconds.
And what about the interface? I mean, would you consider altering it or tweaking it a little bit? Because that's really been an area of strong criticism.
Well, we listen to criticism, so yeah, I'm sure they're going to look into that and they're going to try to make sure that, you know, it'll become better. If nothing else, I do expect that we'll tighten up a lot more. It will make it a little bit more aggressive.
George Stathakopoulos, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Microsoft's George Stathakopoulos there. Now, unless you've been hiding in a ditch lately, you'll know that this podcast's sponsor, CyberTrust, is about to be acquired by Verizon Business. I spoke to Paul O'Rourke, CyberTrust's Senior Vice President and Regional General Manager of the company's Asia-Pacific operations, and his counterpart at Verizon Business, Darren Day, to find out what the acquisition means for the company's staff and the business in general. I guess my first question is for you, Darren. Verizon Business, I'm not really aware of Verizon Business's operations within Australia. Can you tell us a little bit about what Verizon has been up to here prior to this acquisition being announced?
Verizon Business has been in Australia in several forms for about the last 10 years. The company started both as WorldCom or MCI WorldCom and AussieMail, which was then purchased by a company called Uinet. So during those 10 years, we've had a few name changes, and what we focus on now is we're completely focused on the corporate and government space. On the corporate side, it's the enterprise and MNCs, so the higher top 1,000, top 2,000 customers globally and the business that they do in Australia. Verizon Communications purchased MCI at the beginning of 2006, okay. And that was when Verizon Business was born outside the United States.
And how many staff do you actually have here in Australia?
In Australia, we have around about 250, 260 employees spread out primarily in Sydney and Melbourne, but with offices in Canberra, Brisbane, Adelaide and Perth.
Okay, now Paul, CyberTrust here in Australia has around 180 staff, is that correct?
That's correct.
And that actually seems a little bit disproportionate, considering that CyberTrust globally has around 800 staff. I'm just wondering if that's going to make the inevitable sort of restructuring and rejigging of the business a little bit more difficult.
I'll answer that. I'll actually ask Darren to answer the second part of that question. CyberTrust actually runs the Asia-Pacific region from Australia. Okay. We run a very low finance and administration area, very lean. The reason we have such a high proportion of staff in Australia is because of the growth of the business here and because of the incumbency in various sectors, primarily the federal government market in Australia and also the finance and banking finance sector in Australia. Going forward, we see our staff growing.
Okay.
Our professional services capability in Australia spans roughly about 75 people. As demand is growing, we see that capability growing as well.
Now, Darren, I imagine there's a lot of people who are working at Cybertrust who are quite nervous about their jobs. Has there been a decision or, you know, a commitment made towards staffing levels?
No, there hasn't. But one comment that I'd make to back up what Paul said is the thing that's extremely good about this acquisition for Verizon in Asia and particularly in Australia is that the services that Cybertrust provide in security is completely complementary to the Verizon Business market and business. So in Australia and in Asia, the overlap between Cybertrust and Verizon is so small as to be negligible. Verizon Business has ambitions in professional services and has recently hired a director to build that practice, but Cybertrust comes along with a practice, a significant practice already in place. On the security side, we don't have any, or not any, but we have very small amount of security services that we provide as a telco. That's what makes this acquisition for us in Asia so compelling and so important.
So you're suggesting...
contrary to decreasing professional services, given that we run a very technically orientated professional services capability, we do a lot of forensics work, we do a lot of assessment work, we do a lot of asset management work, both at the network and information security level, we see having access to Verizon Business's IP network as providing a huge opportunity for us to sell the professional services through their existing client base and through their channel.
So you're suggesting that perhaps staffers who are concerned about their jobs can breathe easily for now?
There's a transition process now going on, now underway globally with representation from both Cybertrust and Verizon Business. It's fair to say that we can't say with any, completely positively, yes, there's nothing to worry about. But all we can say is based on the facts of the situation, which is Verizon Business essentially has nothing in this space, so there's no overlap, and that we require the services, the security operations center, the professional services, the identity management, and the MS, all the products and services that Cybertrust provide, you would expect that any changes would not be significant in that area. But that's an assumption based on the overlap of the organisation.
Yeah. Do you anticipate that the Cybertrust brand will be ditched?
The Cybertrust name will not go away. How it is used is to be determined, I guess is the best way to say that right now. And that's from John Killian.
Okay, so perhaps something along the lines of EMC's acquisition of RSA, where it becomes the security division of the larger entity.
Yeah, that's correct. And things like the ICSA lab in the US, which is an extremely important independent part of Cybertrust, that is expected to continue to be an independent part of Verizon Business.
Now, why is it that I have not really heard of Verizon Business within Australia when you have 250 staff here?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we launched last year, and towards the end of, in the second half of 2006, we did go on a bit of a media campaign because we're focused on the MNC and that top echelon of customers plus government. Our marketing tends to be fairly targeted. So, for example, we're one of the premium sponsors at the Gartner Symposium at the end of the year to try and get in front of our target customers. We have some advertising at the airport, again, where, you know, CIOs and CXOs tend to travel quite a bit around the region, so to pick them up, at least with a bit of name recognition.
As they drive past that massive Oracle Unbreakable billboard at Sydney Airport.
Yeah, it's more actually as you go through customs, as are all through customs. It's not that we've done nothing, but it has been quite targeted. We certainly need to do more, and through analysts and press and talking to people like yourselves, we're looking to get our name out more.
Do you think we're seeing the end of the, and this is a question for both of you, do you think we're seeing the end of the days of the pure play security professional services firm? Because we're seeing similar mergers, things happening in the US. Aside from what's happened with you guys, we've seen a lot of consolidation in the professional services industry and a lot of larger companies buying practices. I mean, AtStake was purchased by Symantec, for example. Do you think that's a trend? I mean, we might still see the smaller boutique firms, but the larger professional services businesses may be a thing of the past?
My answer would be yes, for one key reason, that is because security has gone up on the requirements for most companies, and it was either buy or build. Now, it takes a long time to buy and get incumbency in this area. because of the trust needed in security. So a lot of the larger companies have sought to buy the capability. And I think what's going to result in is there'll be very few large companies left and more just small consulting boutiques. And we've seen the same with Counterpane being purchased by BT, etc.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, from a telecommunications player, one of the biggest globally, we had security services in the United States, which we'd purchased previously in a purchase of NetSec, when we're MCI. So we see the requirement when we go into our customers as the networks and the services and applications become more converged, our ability to provide security globally to our customer base, our MNC and government customer base, was just becoming a greater and greater priority for us.
There's two other points I'd make. One is one of the reasons it's happening, and I see this a lot in Australia, is the insurance and liability coverage that corporates are seeking from security providers means that small boutiques just can't step up to the onerous obligations.
What sort of liability are we talking? Because I understand the banks require a $20 million public indemnity coverage, but I mean, that's not out of this world in terms of affordability.
No, it's not. But if you're looking at small boutiques, companies, partnerships, just small companies doing consulting, that's a very big liability coverage for them.
Oh, I think it would cost them around $4,000 a year. It's not an insurmountable amount.
Now, not so much at the professional services, at the managed services. It is a harder requirement because of the management of the networks and of the gateways, etc.
But do we actually have small boutiques doing managed services? I understand it's in Australia, it's pretty much just IBM, ISS and you guys.
Not so much in Australia, more the PS, but very much in the region as well. And we're seeing a lot of them either go away or move out of the market or be consolidated.
Paul and Darren, thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Patrick.
Well, that's it for another edition of Risky Business. We'll have more material from Austin in next week's show. For now, though, it's back to the conference for me. Thanks for listening.